An imperfect vessel of an imperfect message, live, the greatness and unimaginable power. This is the Chris Titan Show. Chris Titan. Chris Titan. Chris Titan.
The day came when they met. Andrew was returning from the Crystal Palace, which he had been viewing from the outside. He had walked both ways. Just as he rounded the upper end of Chancery Lane, a man walking rapidly struck against him, whirled him aside, and hurried on. The day was done, but as yet the lamps only dimmed the streets. Andrew had been dreaming, and the jerk woke him to the roar of London. It was as if he had taken his fingers from his ears. He staggered, dazed, against a bus horse, but the next moment he was in pursuit of the stranger. It was but a continuation of his dream. He felt that something was about to happen. He had never seen this man disturbed before. Chancery Lane swarmed with lawyers, but if they had not made any, Andrew would have walked over them. He clove his way between those walking abreast and struck down an arm extended to point out the law courts. When he neared the stranger, he slightly slackened his pace, but it was a stampede even then. Suddenly the pursued came to a dead stop and gazed for 20 minutes in at a pastry cook's window. Andrew waited for him. Then they started off again, much more leisurely. They turned Chancery Lane almost together. All this time Andrew had failed to catch sight of the other man's face. He stopped twice in the Strand for a few minutes. At Charing Cross he seemed at a moment for a loss. Then he sprang across the street and went back the way he came. It was now for the first time that a strange notion illuminated Andrew's brain. It bewildered him and left him in darkness the next moment. But his blood was running hot now, and his eyes were glassy. They turned down Arundel Street. It was getting dark. There were not a dozen people in the narrow thoroughfare. His former thought leapt back into Andrew's mind, not a fancy now, but a fact. The stranger was following someone, too. For what purpose? His own? Andrew did not put the question to himself. They were not 20 yards between the three of them. What Riok saw in front was a short, stout man proceeding cheerfully down the street. He delayed in a doorway to light a cigar, as the stranger stopped as if turned to stone. Andrew stopped too. They were like the wheels of a watch. The first wheel moved on and set the others going again. For 100 yards or more they walked in procession in a westerly direction without meeting a human being. At last the first of the trio half turned on his heel and leant over the embankment. Riok drew back into the shade just before the stranger took a lightning glance behind him. The youth saw his face now. It was never fuller of noble purpose. Yet why did Andrew cry out? The next moment the stranger had darted forward, slipped his arms round the little man's legs, and toppled him into the river. There was a splash, but no shriek. Andrew bound forward, but the stranger held him by one hand. His clear blue eyes looked down a little wistfully upon the young Scotchman, who never felt the fascination of a mastermind more than at that moment. As if feeling his power, the elder man relaxed his hold and pointed to the spot where the victim had disappeared. "He was a good man," he said, more to himself than to Andrew, "and the world has lost a great philanthropist. But he is better as he is."
Here we go. Agent Titan emerges from the tunnels of Set on Easter morning. His skin is a pale translucent with a purple tinge. Better dead. Scottish ley lines cross his timeline to form St. Andrew's Cross. Shiva's irons, via Michael Murphy, revealed the hidden secret. There is a spiritual flesh that is raised from the material flesh. The telluric vril currents are absorbed into and inform the spiritual flesh. A form of consciousness remains. St. Andrew remains, his relics carry with them his ghost. It was the spirit attached to his relics that arrived in Scotland. The spirit of Andrew desired to be with the Scythians who had originally received his message and who had migrated to Scotland, and with them the illuminated dragon blood. This blood would recede into the forest. The quasi-physical body of this race who have attained to the resurrection of the flesh, but spiritual flesh, has become starved and repressed. The exchange of vitality via the blood has degenerated, or not. It is the famished desire for light and consciousness that drives the mystic. Andrew taught the resurrection, and the Scythians realized it, but in doing so had to go underground. Even when they had wandered as far as Scotland. This comprises the underground history for the rite of the Knights of St. Andrew, and comprises the hidden alchemical secret to the transformation of the physical body. A single taper transmuted into the self of Christ. This light is placed in the tomb. Christ descends into hell to liberate the fallen angels. St. Andrew is revealed to be Simbi, a magician from the Congo. Simbi is a serpent loa, takes the form of the Baron of Humboldt Bay. It is Legba who opens the door, but it is Simbi who conducts, leads the loas to accept or reject the sacrifice made at the crossroads. Simbi is the electric currents in the center of the magic wand, the urethra, where Peter, Legba, is the cockhead that opens the door of the vagina tomb, where the death takes place. The aspirant with the broken sword hilt attunes with the light of the world, gives his life to that light to attain to the miracle of rebirth. The broken sword is the word crucified. In the bowels of the fires of hell, new steel is forged. A white-haired hoor with double-edged sword coming from his mouth. At dawning, the taper is taken outside of the circle. The true east-west axis of the circle forms St. Andrew's Cross. As the sun rises and the salmon color tinges the sky, the true light has emerged from hell. The candle is immersed in the water bowl on the altar. Spontaneous analysis of the keyword. INRI.
I don't mind telling you, the stranger said at last, that your case has been under consideration. When we left the embankment, my intention was to dispose of you in a doorway, but your story moves me strangely. Could I be certain that you felt the sacredness of human life, as I fear no boy can feel it, I should be tempted to ask you instead to become one of us. There was something in this remark about the sacredness of human life that was not what Andrew expected, and his answer died unspoken. Youth, continued the stranger, is enthusiasm, but not enthusiasm in a straight line. We are impotent in directing it, like a boy with a toy engine. How carefully the child sets it off, how soon it goes off the rails. So youth is wrecked. The slightest obstacle sends it off on a tangent. The vital force expended in a wrong direction does evil instead of good. You know the story of Atlanta. It has always been misread. She was the type not of woman, but of youth. And Hippomenes personated age. He was the slower runner, but he won the race. And yet how beautiful, even were it to run to riot, must enthusiasm be in such a case as ours. If Atlanta had been Scotch, said Andrew, she would not have lost that race for a pound of apples. The stranger regarded him longingly, like a father only prevented by state reasons from embracing his son. He murmured something that Andrew heartily caught. It sounded like Atlanta would have been better dead. Your nationality is in your favor, he said, and you have served your apprenticeship to our calling. You have been tending towards us ever since you came to London. You are an apple ripe for the plucking, and if you are not plucked now, you will fall. I would fain take you by the hand, and yet I hesitate. You seem a youth of the fairest promise, but how often have I let these impulses deceive me? You talk of logic, but is it more than talk? Man, they say, is a reasonable being. They are wrong. He is only a being capable of reason. Try me, said Andrew. The stranger resumed in a lower key. You do not understand what you ask it yet, he said. Still less what we would ask in return of you. I have seen something today, but you are mistaken in its application. You think I have followed the man lately deceased as pertinaciously as you followed me. You are wrong. When you met me in Chancery Lane, I was in pursuit of a gentleman to whose case I have devoted myself for several days. It has interested me much. There is no reason why I should conceal his name. It is the one honored in this country, Sir Wilfred Lawson. He looked in on this man of business, which delayed me at the shop window of which you have spoken. I waited for him, and I thought I had him this time. But you see, I lost him in the Strand, after all. But the other, then? Andrew asked. Who was he? Oh, I picked him up at Charing Cross. He was better dead. I think, said Andrew hopefully, that my estimate of the sacredness of human life is sufficiently high for your purpose, if that is the only point. Ah, they all say that until they join. I remember an excellent young man who came among us for a time. He seemed discreet beyond his years, and we expected great things of him. But it was the old story. For young men, the cause is as demoralizing as boarding schools are for girls. What did he do? It went to his head. He took a bedroom in Pall Mall and sat at the window with an electric rifle, picking them off at the doorsteps of the clubs. It was a noble idea. But of course it imperiled the very existence of the society. He was a curate. What became of him? Asked Andrew. He is better dead, said the stranger softly.
Yeah, really getting back to the time-traveling Jesuits is where it all started, isn't it?
How does the Dominican fit into all that?
Oh, because this, well, we were trying to trace this whole Better Dead. I mean, this ARG's been going on for several months. And it started out when I was doing a simple investigation into the Discordians and trying to contact Malcolips the Elder, and I found him in the Vatican in, like, the year 2300 or something. And I was shocked to find him in the Vatican, so I started doing research on the Pope, and, like, the first picture of the Pope that I was able to find, he was praying to this picture of a black virgin. Everything kind of got funny after that. Yeah, then somehow we got involved with the Bureau of Sabotage that spun off a movie called Assassination Bureau. Well, because the movie Assassination Bureau was inspired by a novel by Jack London. Notes on that mention that Jack London had read this previous work by J.M. Barrie, who wrote Peter Pan, called Better Dead. And so I was able to access and read it. And I read it really slow. It took me days. It's a fairly short story, but it took me days and days. It starts off all very, very similar, where this guy Andrew Ryok's going to London from Scotland with these great dreams of becoming this internet marketer. Well, he wasn't with. He had some great dreams that were very similar to becoming an internet marketer, and he shops his skills around everywhere, and nobody will hire him. And he ends up just sort of wandering around London. And pretty soon he just starts tailing people for no apparent reason. And that's where I started just tailing people, going out to have coffee and just tailing them around town, tailing them home. I did that for like 2 days. It was really bizarre. Because you had to be sort of careful because you were kind of crossing a line there.
That was before you got to the Better Dead sections themselves, wasn't it?
Yeah, right. And so after that, I was totally immersed in it. And then we got to this point. I was looking at this conversation where, for some reason, so he joins this great. So he trails this one guy. He's tailing this one guy, and he watches. He follows him, and this guy pushes this guy over this ledge into the river, and the guy drowns. Basically, bumps him off. And the guy, instead of killing Andrew Ryok, this guy in the story, he takes him in and he introduces him to this thing called the Society for Doing Without Some People. And basically they're the strange kind of assassination group, right? You get that on the cover, on the surface. But the strangest thing happens when Andrew's hanging out, everyone's staring at his neck. And then there's this one scene before he bails the society altogether where his sponsor jumps him and tries to grab his neck. And it's not really explained. And I didn't really understand it for a few days until one day we were looking at it. And I was actually looking at this poster that's on my wall that I just put up, this Dracula poster, and he's staring at her neck with this intense glare. And we realized that their whole obsession with the neck was because they were vampires. And this is nowhere really implied in the book. This is where we discovered it. And then you realize that the whole thing is these do-gooder vampires who, you know, they only kill people for these ethical reasons. But then they have these really weird standards, you know, of why they're going to kill people, which is kind of humorous.
"But what have I done?" gasped Andrew. "They didn't like your thesis. At least they make that their excuse." "Excuse? Yes, it was really your neck that did it." By this time they were in a cab, rattling into Gray's Inn Road. "They are a poor lot," said Andrew fiercely, "if they couldn't keep their heads over my neck." "They are only human," retorted the president. "For heaven's sakes, pull up the collar of your coat." His fingers were itching, but Andrew did not notice it. "Where are we going?" he asked. "To King's Cross. The Midnight Express leaves in 20 minutes. It is your last chance." Andrew was in a daze. When the president had taken his ticket for Glasgow, he was still groping. The railway officials probably thought him on his honeymoon. They sauntered along the platform, beyond the lights. Andrew, who was very hot, unloosened his great coat. A moment of great change came over his companion. All of the humanity went from his face. His whole figure shook. And it was only by tremendous effort that he chained his hands to his side. your neck, he cried. Cover it up! Andrew did not understand. He looked about him for the committee. There are none of them here, he said feebly. The president had tried to warn him. Now he gave way. The devil that was in him leapt at Andrew's throat. The young Scotchman was knocked into a goods wagon with the president twisted around him. At that moment, there was heard the whistle of the Scotch Express. Your blood be on your own head, cried the president, yielding completely to temptation. His fingers met round the young man's neck. My God, he murmured in delirious ecstasy. What a neck! What a neck! Just then, his foot slipped. He fell. Andrew jumped up and kicked him as hard as he could 3 times. Then he leapt to the platform and, flinging himself into the moving train, fell exhausted onto the seat. Andrew never thought so much of that president again. You cannot respect a man and kick him.